So I'm gonna tell you something, Gary. You met Steve.
Yes.
Everyone here is terrified of the first question I want to ask you.
Okay, don't worry.
Because they're worried you're gonna walk the hell out of here.
No chance.
Or be mad.
No chance.
But I just want to ask you the first question that's honest. This is the New York Times article.
Yeah.
It came out about you about what? A month ago, writing the hashtag in social media marketing.
Yeah.
The underlying current, when people write about you,
yeah,
is who the f*** is this guy?
Yeah.
I mean, you get that, right?
Of course.
Who the f*** are you?
You know, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, really. Like, really, 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 really what I am. I mean, at 4 years old, if you're ripping flowers out of people's yards and ringing their doorbell and desperately asking them to buy it, or when you're six and everybody wants to play dodgeball or go on the swings and you're desperately trying to convince everybody to stand behind a lemonade stand for 8 hours during their summer vacation, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a salesman.
So, but who are you now? Now you have what? VaynerMedia, right?
Right.
290 employees.
Yes.
Pepsi.
Yep.
GE is clients.
Yep.
You told me you just got back from Europe. You keynoted a speech. You charge $50,000 a speech.
Yep.
You got this out.
A little more in Europe. That makes me happy.
Yeah, a little more in Europe?
Sure. It's all time, right? At the end of the day, it's time. So it depends how far I go.
And from what I hear, this is going to be on the New York Times bestseller list. What do you make? What do you make a year?
So you're really going there, huh? You know, it depends. So one of the things that doesn't get talked a lot about is my angel investing.
Mm-hmm.
So this year is going to be a little skewed because, you know, if I decide to sell my Twitter or Facebook stock, it'll get skewed. So where I've made more of my money, so listen, I'm a pretty transparent guy. I make, in the last couple of years, $3 to $5 million a year, depending on what is going to happen, right? And the variable is how much am I going to speak? And the variable is going to be, how much am I gonna sell the investments? Or, you know, when Buddy Media sells last year to Salesforce, I get an exit there. When Wildfire sells to Google, I get an exit there. So my biggest financial variable is what happens with my angel investments. As far as VaynerMedia, it's still a baby company. It's 4 years old. All I'm doing is taking dollars to pay my estimated taxes. I'm investing it all back in building the company.
No, but that's good, because here you are. You're a bestseller giving people advice on how to become successful, specifically how to be successful in the tech world, in social media. And the truth is, I'm not asking you how much you make because I want to be, I don't know, prurient or socially inappropriate. It's like, who is this guy to give us the advice? Now, I know who you are, and I know how successful you've been, but I don't know that everyone does. You know, if we hit the Main Street circuit.
No way.
Who's Gary Vaynerchuk?
99% of people in the world don't know who I am.
But you're a guy that's invested in Twitter, early stage.
Yep.
Facebook.
Yep.
But you know, here, but if you're asking me, the best evidence of who you are is what you just described for us, where you are now and where you started. So the first time I ever heard of you, wine guy.
Yep.
That's in my head.
Yep.
Take me back to the start. Where did you start?
The start of, from the wine world, or even you want me to go?
Yeah, I want the start. Yeah, tell me the start.
You know, I'm the most capitalistic kid. I don't think I'm a kid anymore. Person you'll ever meet. I was born in a communist country. I was born in Belarus, in the former Soviet Union. It was the Soviet Union when I was born. Born in 75 and 78, Israel and the U.S. made a deal with Russia to allow Jews to leave in a trade for wheat. So I was traded for some wheat to get to the United States. We came here, we were poor. I came with my dad.
You're how old?
I'm now 4 years old. My dad, my mom, my grandparents, my uncle, the whole clan came to the United States. I lived in a studio apartment not far from here in Queens with all our family members, you know, 5-6 family members in a studio apartment. My dad gets a job as a stock boy in a liquor store in New Jersey as one of his side jobs, trying to make ends meet. We eventually moved to New Jersey because he becomes the manager of that store as he works his way up. You know, several years later, by not spending any money, saving all his money, that partner realized his future partner, the guy who owned the liquor store, realized he had it. My dad has that entrepreneurial chops, that execution, that drive. He buys in, becomes a partner in a liquor store business, opens a small store in Springfield, New Jersey in 1983. And when I mean small, I mean 300 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
Little house, very small. And so what happens from there is I get involved in that liquor store, which becomes my dad's store after a buyout when I'm 14 years old, packing ice, stocking shelves, firstborn, oldest son, immigrant family. My dad drags me into the business at 14 every weekend, every family vacation. I'm a DNF student. So unlike all my contemporaries, where if you're an immigrant, I know there's a lot of immigrants watching right now, education's your way out. I go a totally different path. My mom supports it because I'm making $2,000 to $3,000 a weekend selling baseball cards, so she sees that I've got it. So I've got this thing going on, this baseball card business, but now I'm brought into the liquor business. And, you know, my parents expect me to work really hard because I'm not going to go to Harvard. And if I'm going to make it in the world, I need to work hard. And that's instilled in me early on. I fall in love with wine when I'm 16, not drinking it. I didn't drink alcohol until I was 20. I mean, just didn't drink. But I fell in love with the fact that people collected wine. So I was lucky that the store was in Springfield, Milburn, New Jersey, which was by Short Hills, all that area.
I heard you talk about the moment. I've heard you even say that, like, the hair on your arm stands up when you talk about the moment.
I don't know if you see it. I don't know.
We'll see if we can get it there. We'll see if we can get it there.
It's the moment.
And a guy walks in, says, I want to buy, what, 3 cases of wine?
Camus Special Select 1990 Cabernet, just named Wine Spectator's Wine of the Year. I'm 16 now, and now I'm really like, wait a minute, I know what this store needs to do, but I don't like selling, you know, Absolute and Coors Light. I don't like that. We don't make any money on it. That blew me away. When I realized, my dad's store was called Shoppers Discount Liquors. When I realized we sold Absolute and Johnny Walker Black and Bud and Coors and Heineken at dead cost, I couldn't understand how we were making money. You know, my dad said we made it up in volume, like volume, lots of zeros. You know, but the truth was there were some dollars here and there, but it was not a very, you know, profitable industry in the discount liquor business. But wine had margin, 20, 50% margin, real margin. And this guy walks in and goes, do you have Camus Special Select Cabernet? And I go, no, we sold out. And he goes, well, can I get 3 cases? I'm like, sure, I'll take a back order. And I said, by the way, are you throwing a party? He goes, no, I collect it. And literally, my life changed. I was like, wait, you collect wine? And I sat there and I said, Frank Thomas, Ken Griffey Jr., Wayne Gretzky, Silver Oak, Camus, Chateau Lafite, same shit. You know, it's the same thing. I can do this. And I basically devoted my life at 16 to learning everything I could about wine.
Yeah, but the path that seems, you would think that would set you on the path to being a wine distributor, a mogul wine distributor across the United States. And it sets you on a very, very different path. You're here to me with a book about social media. So there's a moment when you realize, and it's why I know of you as the wine guy, where YouTube becomes a part of your story.
Before I get to YouTube, and I'll set it up even a little bit more, I'm 19. I'm going to Mount Ida College, you know, small school, crappy school, Mount Ida, you know, and my friend comes, I'm 18, I'm turning 19, my friend runs in and goes, you gotta see this computer thing. I don't own a computer at this point. I've been on a computer like 6 times in class, and I told you what my curriculum and school career looked like, so I didn't even take it seriously. I couldn't type, I didn't know anything about computers, and I hear, and I hear that sound, AOL, dial up, and I look at the internet in 1994 and I go, I can sell on this thing. So what first happened before how you found me was I launched winelibrary.com in 1996. My first prediction of where the world was going wasn't YouTube, it was e-commerce.
And you're in your parents' store at this point. I know you're at college but you've already been working at your parents' store and you realize I can move wine on this thing.
That's right, and I thought what I was gonna do was open up 15 liquor stores in New Jersey and then New York and then Connecticut, and that was I was gonna build, you know, what did I call it? The McDonald's, I think, or the Walmart of wine, and I'll sell that off and buy the New York Jets. We'll get into that, I'm sure, later. What happens then is I'm like, wait a minute, this seems very efficient. I don't need to open up as many stores and I can go global, worldwide. It was very attractive. So I launched winelibrary.com in 1996 and that starts the path of me building a very large business for my family. And what is your next question?
Well, tell me that path. I mean, I've heard you say the stats. You took your dad's wine store from 3 million in sales to 60 million in sales.
That's
how quickly did that go?
It went 3, it went 8, it went 12, it went 22. 35. So it happened very, very quickly. And for a small family liquor business, immigrant family, it was a big culture change, right? Like things,
right.
It was just like, it changed our lives. But it was about the innovation. Nobody was building e-commerce sites. Nobody was
What's your dad think at this point? Here's your dad, an immigrant from Belarus. He's, I'm sure, sitting here thinking, you know, it's about nose to the grindstone, elbow grease, and you're over here playing on the internet and you've taken my business from 3 to 60 million. How does he respond to that?
You know, interestingly, I think my dad's my biggest fan, but he's also very competitive. I mean, one of the biggest drivers to my success is my competitive nature, and my dad's competitive. I don't think he's not like, oh, my son saved me. You know, in his mind, you know, his son's lucky to have the opportunity to be doing this because he brought his family over from the Soviet Union and grinded from zero money, no language. I know my dad, and so what my dad is he's very proud. I'm his son, right? Very proud. But he's equally proud and equally holds on to the fact that he built the foundation. And as I tend to get older, I tend to respect his 0 to 3 even more than what I've done at times. It's interesting. At first, I was competitive myself. I'm like, look what I did. But now, you know, when you come from zero and you can't speak the language and you're able to really, I mean, from 1978 to 1983 in a 5-year window, my dad went from having $100 and no language to being part owner of a liquor store. I mean, it's pretty incredible. So, you know, what does he think? The cliche thing that people think is like, I've done it. He thinks that he did it and gave me the opportunity. And, you know, in his mind, he's probably right.
Tell me about that video, the first videos you made on YouTube.
I mean, you
didn't go out and make advertisements on YouTube. What did you do?
So in 2006, I had my second aha moment. So obviously the wine.library.com movement changed everything. It's why we built such a big business. YouTube changed the next step of it. The reason you know me. In 2006, February 2006, less than a year after YouTube came out, I'm like, okay, this thing's gonna be humongous. This is gonna change the world. Let me start a wine show. I never thought of myself as a personality that way, but I was like, I gotta test this, I gotta learn this. It's always been my nature. I'm always gonna be that person to try something first. So I sit down on February 21st, 2006, and I tape a show where I taste 3 wines, and I remember learning enough about the internet at that point that I knew that I couldn't do QVC and Crazy Eddie and sell people, right? I knew that what I wanted to do was become Robert Parker, the wine spectator for a new generation. I wanted to become the media.
So was your goal not necessarily to move wine at your dad's store?
I knew that it would be a byproduct, but I knew the best way to actually make that happen was to become the media. In this book, in one of the chapters, I tell everybody's watching right now, you're in the media business, comma, you're a lawyer. You're in the media business, comma, you sell wine. You're in the media business, comma, you sell sneakers. I mean, Red Bull is the first big company, I think, to figure this out. This whole thing figured it out. This is coming.
So the other thing you say in this book, it's interesting, you said you knew moving wine sales would be a byproduct.
Yes.
But you went out there to give wine reviews. And of course, I mean, to get to the punchline of that story, it took off. I mean, you started getting, your first video got how many views?
30, 75. I mean, nobody watched. I mean, here's something that I'd love to talk about that I don't think people, and I think people that watch this show will value. Patience is grossly underestimated. You know, I was very successful. My wine business is growing. Now I start doing this show and spending all my time trying to promote this show. And the sales of Wine Library start flattening out because I was the engine, right? So I had to simultaneously start building back up other engines besides me and do this show. And the show wasn't getting watched. I mean, I'm a year in now. I, for the first time ever, I'm not growing as rapidly as I was because I'm distracted, but I knew this was right. And the show really didn't take off until mid-2007 when New York Magazine did a profile on it, which led to Joel Stein seeing it. Then he did a huge profile in Time. Then Conan O'Brien's producers saw that, put me on the Conan show. So it was old media along with the internet, Lifehacker, and all these blogs. And then it was really mid-07, a year and a half in, of 5 days a week of doing a show, getting only hundreds, then a couple thousand views, and then it kind of took off.
I mean, I think what's fascinating about the story is that at that point in your story, before Conan O'Brien calls, it's not that unique. I mean, it is from an immigrant standpoint, but there are people across this country whose parents have $3 million businesses, and they start little Twitter feeds, Facebook accounts, do YouTube videos, and somehow yours became what we talked about at the beginning of this interview. It became who you are now. That video that you put on YouTube that went from 30 views, so I don't know what it is, millions of views, to Conan O'Brien, that broke through. And so let's go back to that byproduct concept. You didn't go to sell wine. You went to give wine reviews, and that's what you're saying here, essentially. Jab, 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 right hook. You're give, give, give. Is that what jab, jab, jab is? It's give, give, give?
That's right, and the right hook is the ask. And so, under the context of business, you're exactly right. Wine Library TV was just one humongous jab. You know, by giving out advice, and by panning wines that I actually sold, which was such a brain twist for where America commerce was in 2006. I think we're getting into the warm and fuzzy, transparent world now, where honesty and all these other nice things are starting to actually have value. But in 2006, we were still in the let's sell stuff world. And for me to throw that curveball was weird for people. I mean, I've got cases downstairs of this wine, and here I am saying this wine tastes like, you know, crap. This wine is awful. It's overpriced. These are suppliers and wineries that I'm friends with. It really confused the market. But I knew that I was bringing value to that person, and that was the game. That, you know, if I can bring value to the audience, that I will then have the equity, and then that equity allows me to actually have a chance to sell them and make them part of my family.
Okay, so now you have VaynerMedia, which you consult companies, like I said, Pepsi and GE, on how to make this same leap. So be specific with me. What do you mean jab, 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 right hook, give, ask? Give me some examples of give.
Yeah, so give is lightweight thing. So here's the one thing I want everybody to pay attention to. Take a look at the homepage of your phone, right? Take your phone out. Everybody at home right now, take your phone out. Take your phone out and look what's on your phone. There's only three things on your phone: escapism and entertainment, information and utility, and social, people. So you have Facebook and Twitter and that stuff. You have utility, your calendar, Evernote, your to-do list, and then entertainment, some games and music. Nobody has anything else on the homepage of their phone, the home screen. And by the way, the home screen of a telephone today in our society is the biggest gateway to the psychology of human beings on earth. So the way you give is by doing one of those three things. So when we have a client, like Mountain Dew as a client, when we post something on Facebook, it could be entertainment. It could just be a 30-second video of a skateboarder, and for that demo, that's entertainment, right? They're putting out content. They're a media company. It could be happy holidays. It's just acting nice. It's just putting out something lightweight. We've been growing up in a world where for the last 70 years, every business has been selling to us every word out of their mouth. Every word out of every mouth of every brand, because of television, print, radio, and billboards, and direct mail, has been selling because they're only getting one right hook. It costs a lot to produce a commercial. On social, you can produce so much content at value, at volume, excuse me, that you can put out content that's valuable. So here's a good one. If you're Dove, which is a client, if you put a post on Facebook that says three apps that will make your life better, mom, and it's a utility app, it's a dry cleaner app that saves you money, you've provided value for that person. That then sets up what most people do on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, is put out stuff that wants to sell. And so there's a lot of ways to put out value. You just have to become a media company.
So you're pitching social media to these companies, Pepsi, Dove, so forth. If I think about traditional, old media, TV, direct mail, back of the magazine, it's not hard for me to come up with companies that became massively successful by buying all in to
yes.
those medias. I mean, Sears Roebuck, direct mail.
Yes.
What Ovaltine, was that?
Yes.
TV, radio.
Yes.
What is the success story? What is the social media buy-in company success story? Who's done it? Who can we look at and go, that was built on social media?
Warby Parker, Birchbox, the people that actually go all in. You know, obviously you referenced in the front the New York Times article. The best part of that article was the last part, which is one of our clients, Nilla Wafers. You know, people in the South, they love it. That's where it sells. You know, they put all their money into social with us.
Tell us that story. I know Nilla sure. Wafer did a test and decided we're going to go
by the way, I wish I was smarter. This story pisses me off, to be honest with you, because it shows a lack of smart strategically for me, which breaks my heart. I wasn't smart enough in the first 3.5 years of VaynerMedia to realize the way I was going to prove the ROI of social media was to get a client to give me all their budget. And it happened serendipitously. We had half of Nilla's budget. The other half was supposed to do some contests, some bull crap, stuff that wasn't going to work. Somehow that fell through, and Nilla said, you know what? You take it. And so we had the entire budget, and so this is a brand that hadn't grown for a decade. Flat sales. This was all we did was pictures and videos and micro content, what I talk about in the book, on Facebook and Pinterest mainly, Twitter as well. And here we are a year later, and the business is up 9%. It's a phenomenal success story, because this isn't about impressions. This isn't about Nielsen ratings. This is we sold a lot more stuff. That's actual business. And so I hope that people look at the Nilla story as the real case study and in this time, because it's very early. Listen, there wasn't a lot of e-commerce success stories when I started with Line. If you asked me right now, in 1999, what are the e-commerce success stories, Gary? You're saying this winelibrary.com thing is gonna be good. I could point to Amazon having early traction, but it was hard. We didn't have all the things we have now. And so the people that are successful right now are brands that are direct to consumer and or are super small right now that we haven't heard of before. And so that's why a Birchbox or a Warby Parker, which is more of a digital native company, a direct to consumer internet-based company, because the big brands, Nikes and Reeboks and Pumas and fashion Levi's, and they're not going 100% all in, so there's no way to really, they've already got all these other media models that can take the credit for the success.
You know, when you put this concept forward, jab, 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 right hook, give, then ask. I mean, what you're talking about essentially is developing a relationship with this consumer, is it not?
Absolutely. The problem is nobody has the patience. You know, there's one dirty secret about social media that I haven't talked a lot about, and since this is a really awesome interview format, let's go into it. We're getting tricked. This is something I've just realized within the last month. We're getting tricked by social media because email marketing, direct email marketing, banner ad retargeting, all the stuff that SEO and SEM, all the stuff we did, me, with Wine Library and all the guys that won and gals that won in the early days, that was all instantaneous. You send out an email, you sell wine. You put out Google AdWords ad campaign, you get traction, right? You put out banners on websites and you cookie them and you follow them around and show them more banners, they eventually give up and buy your wine. All of it was instant gratification. Social isn't. The best results we've seen from social are taking 6 months, a year before we start seeing any kind of results. And we live in an ADD culture now, my man.
But what's the trick? You said there's a trick to this.
Well, the trick is, that's my slang term for, the trick is everybody's confused by this because they want to see instant results. You hire somebody or you do it internally, you post it on Facebook, you expect something to happen.
Well, let me ask you this though. You said we're entering an age of honesty and we're talking about establishing a relationship with the consumer, right?
Yes.
Give, 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 then ask. Mm-hmm. Is there not a trick to that? Are you establishing a relationship with the consumer that they don't actually know at some point? You're manipulating them into the ask.
You know, I think that this was the tone that the Times article took that really pissed me off, to be honest with you. You're following a friggin' brand. I mean, who in the world thinks that they're having any kind of relationship with Nike that isn't predicated on some, thank you. I mean, I see your natural, right? Thank you. I appreciate that because that's a very natural reaction from you. That is, it's such an easy answer for me because what, you think Dunkin' Donuts wants to be your best friend? I mean, like, this is predicated on commerce, but I think it's a hell of a lot better than them just asking you all the time.
But you have said that you think all relationships are kind of transactional. I think you described it as leverage.
Under the context of business. Under the context of business.
Actually, if you, but Gary, if you had said all relationships, you wouldn't offend me. I read that and I'm like, I'll bet you, and you're backing away from it if I extend it to all relationships. I'll bet you some people won't like that. I mean, is love not transactional? You give me love,
listen,
I give you love, it makes us both better off.
I mean, listen, I'm fine with that. I'm not trying to waver. I'm thrilled to piss people off. I prefer it. It's not where I'm going. I just want to, you know, to me, there's a purity to capitalism that I adore. I love when companies go out of business. I'd love for one of my companies to go out of business because then I deserve it. It means I misplayed the market, somebody did it better, and that's, so there's a purity to capitalism.
Did you see Jeff Bezos on 60 Minutes where they ask him the question, look, do you feel bad about the fact that Amazon is putting all these companies out of business by undercutting them on prices? In fact, selling them at a loss often to be the volume leader. He said, Amazon didn't happen to those companies. The future happened to those companies.
Yeah, I think he's right. I mean, this is why, I'm a huge fan of his. That's right. I mean, I don't care if you're small. Small wins all the time in business. You know how dumb big is? I work with a lot of dumb big. Big is dumb. And so you've got to adjust to the reality of the market. Innovation doesn't care about you and me. It's just going to do its thing, period.
All right, so I want you to do this. Take me through your day. Start me out. Gary Vaynerchuk wakes up. Take me through your day.
I wake up at 7 a.m. I take my laptop. I go take a crap, and I go on techmeme.com.
You take it with you to the
Absolutely.
To the head?
I go right to the crapper, and I take my laptop with me, and I go to techmeme.com, which is a website that aggregates all the tech news to make sure I didn't miss anything, to make sure in those 5 or 6 hours that I slept, something important didn't happen. I check my email. I go directly to Twitter, and I see everybody who at Gary V'd me to see if there's anything that anybody expects from me from my community. I then, spend 2 minutes with my family, unfortunately, kiss, and I'm on my way. No consistency to my day. I travel 100 days a year. I could go speaking. I could be going seeing a client. I could be looking at an angel investment. When I'm in New York, I'm going to the office, but I could be going to a client that's local. And the rest of the day is really predicated on a couple of categories. Meetings with my staff at VaynerMedia, meetings with clients at VaynerMedia, strategy meetings of that nature, or I'm meeting with startup entrepreneurs to invest in, or I'm meeting with press or doing things if I'm in my book mode or speaking mode.
Well, so let's put some numbers on this because I've obviously read about you. You want to do 315 interviews this year, something like that, 350, whatever, one a day.
Yep.
You're not on pace for that, right?
I want to do 365.
There it is.
The truth is that the person that was running the program dropped the ball enough. And, unfortunately, she's lovely. I love her, but it didn't work out. And so I missed, 30 or 40 here and there, double bookings, like just sloppiness of execution. But I did a pretty good job. I mean,
what number is this?
This will probably be December. Probably 305.
Oh, you're close.
I'm close.
You're close. I hope you can fit in two a day. you tweet 70 times a day.
That's on average. We ran the numbers for that article. And again, 60 of those, or 65, are me replying to someone.
That's what I find the most fascinating. So let me tell you this. I hate Twitter. Okay.
Yep.
I know you love Twitter.
Yeah.
And I want you to make me love it, and I want you to make me good at Twitter.
I prefer not to make you good at it, because if you're good at it, then I'm less good at it.
Oh,
right?
That's not a zero-sum game, like, is it?
No, it's not.
No, but here's why. I think I treat Twitter the same way you do. And you come away loving it, and I come away hating it. What I get from Twitter is a lack of engagement. So to me, Twitter is a broadcast mechanism for 140 characters of pure snark or pure genius that you think you're giving out to the world. That's the part that I hate. I actually like the engagement. When somebody responds, you and I talking right now, I like this. And to the extent that Twitter can give me that, but I don't see that it gives me that
much.
You
know why? Because you're not starting with listening.
Explain that to me.
You need to go to search.twitter.com. You need to go to search. You're waiting for people to respond to your genius or snark. The best way to get that to happen is for you to first go into Twitter search, search subject matters that you're interested in and have knowledge about, search what other people are saying, and then jump in and respond and actually...
So go seek out the conversation.
Absolutely. See, this is where there's an entitlement issue at hand.
Don't worry, you're not going to offend me.
Yeah, I know that. I can tell already by the tone. There's an entitlement issue at hand that a lot of people take to Twitter. To me, if you listen first, you then start having the equity. If you jab first, you have the equity for your right hook. For me, I can be consistently kept busy by engagement because I've created an expectation that I'll respond, which feeds the animal. I mean, I'm going to walk out of here right now, and in a 20-minute cab ride down to my office, I'm going to respond to the 4,500 tweets that came in while we're sitting here because they know I'm going to.
This isn't live, so you're not going to.
But, you know.
So I want to talk about the concept. When you talk about that, right, and we're
talking. You know what's so funny about that? What? I'm not talking predicated on this. I'm talking predicated that's living all the time.
Right.
Because I've created that world.
That it's just a constant conversation.
It's a constant conversation.
Yeah.
And it's not based on my amazing statement that then I get response to. It's based on it's always live.
You ever have trouble turning off?
Yeah.
How do you make time for your family?
Extremism. In 2013, if we did this interview a year ago, I would bullshit some sort of
answer. You've got kids, right?
Two, a four-year-old and a one-year-old. And, you know, I'm starting to also, it's going to have to evolve because I can see what's happening with the four-year-old, and as that four to 12-year-old range comes, it becomes more time-consuming. So I'll adjust, but the way I do it now is extremism. I work 7 a.m. till midnight, and not bullshit midnight. I mean, I get home at midnight. Not I get home at 9 and I'm on the email a little bit. I mean, I walk in my door at midnight Monday through Friday. And then Saturday and Sunday, though, I've been able to, in this year, never before, pretty much shut out.
What does that mean? Put that phone down,
yeah,
not pick it up?
Yeah, and that's stunning to me. I can't even believe I'm there, but it makes me happy. And it gives me the ability to actually have that time.
Look, you talk a lot about hustle.
It's the biggest
hard
thing
work.
I believe in.
Going for it. When we were standing out in the green room, you said it's a grind. It's not about hitting home runs. It's about hitting singles. It's a grind. But you ever get distracted? I mean, do you get drunk?
Physically drunk?
Yeah.
Like four times a year. No.
Do you sit inside all day and watch movies?
Never.
You have nothing.
The Jets.
The Jets,
the
yes.
Jets every Sunday for 4 hours. I don't care if the internet and alcohol became illegal. If somebody texted me first quarter of Jets game against the Carolina Panthers and they said, you know, bad news, Obama made alcohol and the internet illegal, I wouldn't give a f**k. I'd wait for the game to be over and then I'd deal with it. So that is my complete escape.
Now is my opportunity to ask you the question that everybody asks you, which you want to buy the New York Jets?
That's right. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's the professional goal. But, you know, to me, that's like a funny little thing, right? For me, what it's really about is the climb. I love the game. I love the game. I love the grind. I love that I took a red eye from London right now and ran over here instead of saying, like, why? Like I love that about me. I love that about it, and I love doing it. And to me, by having such a hefty goal, like a $2 billion sports franchise, it's going to keep me busy.
No, you know, Nick Saban, coach of the Alabama Crimson Tide, for now. We'll see in a couple days if he's not the coach of the Texas Longhorns. I saw him after he won the national championship. I think his first of the three he's won at Alabama. And they said, was this always the goal? To win the national championship, was this the goal? He said, we don't focus on goals here. I focus on process. I focus on practice, recruiting, not only that, blocking and tackling. Clearly, your desire, not just your desire, the fact that it fulfills you, waking up, tweeting 70 times a day with little replies that are hitting one at a time, picking up customers one at a time, clearly that's the path to success. It can't be, I'm going to own the New York Jets.
It's my path to success.
No, I think
right?
It's the path to success.
I think there's different ways to slice it. I really do. I truly do. I truly do. I think what I did well, if I could bless everybody with one characteristic I have, it's not the hustle, it's not the stunning good looks, it's one thing. It's self-awareness. I know what I'm good at, and I know what I suck at. And boy, do I suck at a ton of stuff. But
what do you suck at?
Pretty much everything. I suck at follow-up, like micro follow-up. Like small details mean nothing to me. But small details, and it's funny, you were barking up small details matter to me.
Right.
Small details on the follow-up, I struggle with. I'm very good at the, it's why Twitter's so good for me. I'm doing the deed in the moment. If it was about, hey, Gary, call me in an hour, death.
Wow.
Got it? So like scheduling, like, so executing in the moment, I'm great. Executing a process over time, I'm too up here. It's too, nothing is a big deal to me. Everything, there's always a bigger thing going on. And so like, I need to surround myself with great people. You know, I'm bad at that. I'm bad at smelling the roses, which I think could burn me out. Listen.
Coming in the door at midnight is gonna do that to you.
Listen, I have a very good chance. I'm super self-aware that I can wake up at 65 and have regret and be angry at, why did I go one-on-one when I had these bigger opportunities? Listen, all my contemporaries around me and the people that care about me are concerned that I focus on too many little things, leaving bigger things on the table. If you're spending 4 to 5 hours a day engaging, I'm the head of HR at VaynerMedia because I want to build a real culture. So I'm spending a half an hour with a community manager that's been there for a week instead of going and having a big time meeting with some big executive. I'm trading off bigger plays for smaller plays.
But don't you feel like, so I completely get that analysis, but it also seems like, and this may be repetitive, that is what got you where you were. Why would you divorce yourself from it now? I can't get away from the fact, I'm fascinated with the statistic that whatever it is, 60, 70, 80% of your tweets are at replies, meaning you're hitting them one at a time. You know, in The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell talked about, you know, finding the way that trends catch on is you find that one person. That there are movers in our society that are viral beings. And once you hit that guy, he disseminates it to 10, 100 guys. I mean, are you guys saying the same thing here? Or are you picking them off one at a time regardless of their influence?
I'm picking them off one regardless of their influence. As a matter of fact, I actually think people of influence are decaying because they're on 24/7 and they're pitching stuff all the time. I mean, I don't believe a single opinion of a celebrity at all because I know what the back end looks like. And I believe that they're pitching and that there's alternative motives. To me, I'd far rather win over Sally Arkansas, who has 17 friends, that she's gonna tell the story of Gary Vee actually giving a crap about her over and over to those 17 people. I actually think over time, that has a better win rate.
I wonder if your relationship with these people, with your customers, is authentic. You know, I asked you earlier.
I get that.
What's that?
I get that. Here's why it's authentic to me. I have zero.
Yeah, I can't decide, honestly. I'm sitting here listening to you. When you reply one at a time,
yeah,
you're building a relationship.
Absolutely. Here's why I think I win the game ultimately and don't lose it ultimately. If there was to be a decision, whether it was real or horse, I have zero expectation to convert the right hook. That's why
I wrote a book, though. It's called Jab, 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 Right Hook.
Yeah.
It's the presumption is there's a right hook.
There is. Doesn't mean you're necessarily going to nail it. I mean, I believe that if you throw enough jabs, you nail it. I think it's a hell of a lot better than what everybody else is doing, which is right hook, right hook, right hook, right hook. But for me, not for my clients. Listen, my clients expect to land their right hook. Now, the good news is for my clients, they are a brand and people expect them to sell them something. When you get into a human being, you get into the cynicism of what is happening here. For me, what enables me to get away with it, what enables me to long-term win this game in my mind, is I actually have zero expectation. I wouldn't be disappointed if I gave to somebody, if I answered 43 of their emails and 91 of their tweets, and when I posted, did you buy my, listen, I've done it. I'm testing myself to see if I still feel this way. I tweeted the other day, have you bought my book yet? And there are people there that I've given so much to that answered no. And I'm like, it's $18. And you like, and so, but the good news is I'll have that moment of it's $18. How did you not support me that way after I gave you that email answer, after I introduced you to that person, after I responded to you 43 times this year, which is something nobody else that you want to do is doing. Deep down, I'm okay with it because I do not believe I'm entitled to anything. And that lack of entitlement is ultimately the thing that gets me through.
I started this interview and I asked you, who the f*** are you, right? I knew the answer to it, but I needed to hear it. So now tell me this. Who do your critics think you are? Like, what's the biggest criticism of you that you get over and over?
That's a great question. I think that people think I'm a motivational speaker.
So what does that mean, a bull****?
artist?
Yeah. I think people think I'm a bullshit artist. And I, you know what? I understand why. I on paper, meaning if you catch me in the right environment, if you catch me in, if you clip certain parts of this interview, you can paint a very bullshit artist narrative. I get it. I think a lot of people are cynical. I also think that we live in a society where there's been plenty of bullshit artists, and I communicate like one. I'm not confused by that. That's the self-awareness. I understand that.
What do you mean you communicate like this? Is this a Jersey guy?
I think Belarusian.
What is this? I know what you mean. You speak
hyperbole,
in certainties.
There's yeah. like there, you know. I speak in certainties. I'm opinionated. I speak to things. I build businesses around my opinion. So of course I'm talking about my belief in Snapchat. I have vested interest in Snapchat being more important than print for my VaynerMedia, right? Of course I believe in smart everything. I'm an investor in Uber. So what I back all my actions, which then makes somebody say, well, wait a minute, what's his agenda here? I respect that. The reason I'm at peace is this plays itself out. Here's what I do know. I have less cynics than I did before from the group that knows me. As I become more known, if that happens, back to your earlier point, which is 99% of the people don't know who I am, as I continue to get known, I continue to have to play that game. It's the same game for me, Will. It's my whole life. It's 85% of people like me from the get, 15% don't. Of that 15%, over a very short period of time, I'm able to get 11 to 12% to like me more. And then there's a small group that won't.
No, I've got no reason to say this because this interview's almost over. But what is clear to me is those people that know you seem to like you. And those that don't, there's your pool of people who think you're a bullshit artist.
And that makes me happy, right? Like I think you can win that game in today's society because there's so much information. You're right. You're doing your homework. Like, people that... Here's why I'm winning. The most cynical of people that friends of friends will talk, and if the subject comes up, where they're used to that person saying that guy's full of crap or that girl's full of crap, when they get the answer that I'm not, because that person that's cynical had interacted with me or actually looked under the hood, I'll win that game eventually.
I do think you're authentic. I asked you that. And that is the ultimate currency to me. Like, this was my major, broadcast journalism. I left it because it's like, you're going to school to learn how to become an actor, how to play good on a TV like that. That is the ultimate pretend game. That's not authentic. I came back to this because in 2008, during the election cycle, I felt like what the debate, the conversation we had was so false. Surely there is a market opening for authenticity. Surely you can create a TV show that shows all of this behind the scenes, that doesn't need to pretend to play TV. That's why I asked the camera to go out there when you and I walked in. It's like, we're not playing TV.
This is
two guys having a conversation, and I don't know. That may be the next step of marketing, right? It is, don't pretend to sell. Don't always sell. Create a true, authentic relationship. Everyone's a media company, just be real.
Yes. the reason it's so easy for me to say that is I wrote Crush It in 2009. What you just said is basically the entire thesis of a book I wrote 5 years ago, which is the internet, YouTube, and other things of that nature are gonna create a platform for people to be able to do whatever they want. There isn't gonna be 4 to 5 moguls that own media that control what the world sees. And because of that, we're gonna get alternative, authentic, and opportunistic people put storytelling to the world. And that's what you guys are doing here quite well.
I'm gonna ask you some authentically bullshit questions at the end of this deal, okay?
Okay.
You're gonna spend the next 6 months addicted to one of these three drugs, okay? You have to pick. I'm gonna pull a gun.
I'm gonna pull
the trigger. It's at your forehead, all right?
You should know that I've never even smoked a cigarette, so I'm gonna struggle with this question.
That's good. Meth.
Okay.
Crystal meth.
Okay.
Heroin.
Yep.
PCP. 6 months. Horribly, horribly addicted. At the end of 6 months, you're gonna come out of this okay. But that's how you're spending your next 6 months.
So this is an authentic question because I don't know much about it. Which one's the worst of those three?
Well, I think that's subjective.
Is it?
Crystal meth, you're gonna get a lot of stuff done. You might lose some teeth and some facial structure.
Okay.
PCP, you could lose your mind, but you're gonna have some good stories at the end of that deal.
Well, that would probably then be it.
And so supposedly heroin, I wouldn't know the answer to any of these, by the way. This is just what I've read. Heroin is the best, is what I've heard. But you may never come out at the end of that 6 months.
I would go with PCP then because for me, I'm a storyteller, and if I can get stories out of it, that would make those 6 months.
I would have guessed meth, though, because you seem like a guy who likes to get stuff done.
I mean, the teeth scare me. You know, I like the teeth.
All right, so you're going to have to, I think you started to answer this earlier. For the next year, you're giving up one of these, zero of this product.
Okay.
That cell phone in your pocket?
Never. I can
or
tell
sex.
You that right now. Sex.
I like how easy that was
for you. That was so easy for me. that was very easy.
Would you rather, okay, look, this is good. I'm a huge Cowboys, Mavericks, Rangers, Texas Longhorns fan. Mark Cuban owns the Dallas Mavericks,
yes.
But he's from Pittsburgh.
Yes.
He is a Steelers, Penguins, Pirates fan.
Yes.
You don't get to pick the sports team you own. Rarely. The timing's not right. So you're going to get to own a sports team, Vaynerchuk, but it's going to be the Miami Dolphins. Take the deal?
That's a really good question. I'm impressed by you right now. I don't know. Here's my intuition on this. I would probably buy an NBA team out of market rather than buying an NFL team.
Because you just couldn't root against the Jets?
I really wouldn't want to. I'm not, listen, I have a very easy chance here to say never, right? But I won't do it, which means that I might. So, I mean, I know myself. You asked me a great question that I've honestly been waiting for this. I mean, I do a lot of interviews. Forget about the little ones that I've done 300. I do a lot of stuff.
And the Dolphins Jet ones, that's what really got you.
It's just the notion of the Patriots would be even worse. I would buy an NBA team.
Yeah. All right, last one. And you may have already answered this one. Actually, this will be good. This will be a little revealing. You have to disconnect for a year off the grid. No phone, no nothing. Disconnect for a year. But I'll give you, for you, you said you make $3 to $5 million a year. It's going to have to be enticing. I'll give you $10 million to disconnect for that year. Would you do the deal?
No way. Because even I make $3 to $5 million and I'm hedging. I'm not cashing in. I'm leaving so much money on the table every year.
So it's not about the need to be connected. It's that you're going to keep doubling up on your own without the need.
Yeah, I need, I'm building blocks. And to be off for a year, I wouldn't be able to build the blocks. And $10 million to be off and then the startup.
What is your number then if it's not $10 million?
I'd take $100 million. I would. Because that I feel like, it also depends on the variables, right? Am I with my family? Is it somewhere nice and warm? Am I going to like get healthy, lose some weight? Like, can I get a trainer? There's the variables. But I'd take a hundo.
All right, Gary, man. It's been good
talking
to you.
This was a lot of fun. Yeah. You did a great job.
Steve, you said something at the end. I couldn't hear you. Do you want me to ask Gary? We did a wrap, but... Oh, okay. Good, man. I really did enjoy it.
That was great. You were great.
We almost pulled a switch on you at the very end and took you to a wine bar.
Is that right?
Yeah. I don't know shit about wine. Are you political at all, Gary?
Not really. I've voted both parties multiple times.
Your love of capitalism has got to lead you in one direction.
It does, but I'm also too affected socially sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm also completely of the notion of like the government can't stop me. I'm so weird that way.
No,
I'm probably
not. That's the entrepreneur in you. And I came from an entrepreneurial side. I started two companies before this. And there is an optimism to entrepreneurialism.
Absolutely.
You know what? You're gonna put in this regulation. You're gonna put in this tax structure. I'm still gonna turn on.
I'm too
and
fast.
I'm above
that's
this.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Thanks,
right,
brother.
Man,
have a great holiday. Thank you.